This is the Coast 89.7 Weekly News Magazine, Dialogue, highlighting local news stories and events in our Cape Breton communities.
Hello, welcome back to Dialogue on the Coast 89.7. I'm Bill McCush. This week, Cape Bretoners on the southeastern part of the island are worried about the risk of wildfires. There is a golden anniversary on the Diamond in Sydney this year. The public market is moving to the waterfront campus, and Ottawa is offering support to a Crown corporation on the north side. These stories are coming up on the Coast 89.7. A Mount Allison University researcher says some residents are concerned about the threat of wildfires in southeastern Cape Breton this summer. Dr. Corinne Cash recently hosted information sessions about her research into the impact of Storm Fiona in 2022. She says damaged and fallen trees remain in vulnerable areas.
There is a lot of trees down, and they've been down since Fiona. And the problem is that usually when trees fall down like that, it takes about 3 years for them to decompose, and then the forest starts to grow again. And while there are trees that are starting to grow, because we've had such dry weather over the past few years, they haven't been decomposing, and they're still on their sides. They're still, it looks like a big matchbox just ready to go up.
With forecasters predicting above average temperatures and the risk of drought this summer, Cash says people expressed worry that a fire in the Louisbourg-Gabarus area could be devastating.
That entire area is going to go up in flames, and there really is only one way in and out of Louisbourg. So in any kind of event, if there is an ice storm or if there's a power outage or anything, there's still that only one road. But in case of a fire, they're essentially locked in Louisbourg. The road to Gabarus was started but not finished, so residents want that road finished so that there's another exit route in case of a fire.
Cash says with the hot, dry conditions expected this summer, people should be cautious and take extra care because some fires are preventable.
Somebody can throw out a cigarette, a piece of glass might start a fire. I had a friend the other day, he looked into his ditch and all of a sudden there were flames. He ran down and put it out with some buckets of water. These things can happen at any time, or you get a spark from a transformer. They've been buzzing in Louisbourg and they've been sparking, probably because of the salt water, but any kind of spark like that can just set the entire thing on fire. And a lot of people still aren't recovering from Hurricane Fiona, would you believe? I talked to people who are just getting into their home now from Hurricane Fiona.
Cash mentioned a friend who saw a fire in a ditch near his home in Sydney Forks. His name is Lyndon McIntyre.
I was just was getting ready for work. Actually, I was on a later shift at work. I do one night a week. It's a later shift, so that's the only reason why I caught it. But I was just looking out the window, and I just noticed smoke coming from the ditch at the bottom of my driveway. So I ran down to see what it actually was. And sure enough, it was there's a bunch of leaves, dead leaves in the ditch there. And it was kind of smoldering up. There's a little kind of hill in the ditch. And so I just ran up to the house and filled up buckets and jugs of water and just basically put it out. There was a lady pulled over in the car, and she just said, "Do you want me to call the fire department?" I said, "Yes, no, absolutely." So they did come, but I had it out by then, so it was pretty early in the start of it. So I don't know what caused it. Maybe a cigarette butt or something. Someone threw out the window. I have no idea. It could have been bad. Yeah, for sure.
Catalone Gut resident Mike Timoshek attended one of Cash's information sessions stemming from the storm 4 years ago, and he says trees damaged by Fiona would provide plenty of fuel for a wildfire.
Yeah, the deadfall is the stuff that's hanging up. If you drive along the highway, you see it. It's all gray now and tinder dry. It doesn't get a chance to fall on the ground and absorb the moisture and decay naturally. And that's the real concern.
Timoshek refers to a tragic fire this month in 1976, where a nearby village was nearly destroyed. 16 homes and the community's Catholic church burned to the ground. Luckily, no one was killed.
Interestingly enough, my wife was in Manadou when Manadou burnt down. 50 years ago. And that's a one way in, one way out. And so some of the townsfolk had to leave by boat because the fire was encroaching on the community. Lewisburg is a one way in, one way out. And so if we have a large conflagration, people can't get out. They're literally trapped because there's no route to Gabarus. There's only actually two roads out, but they both conjunct at the beginning of Lewisburg, and a fire on either road will close both of them.
That's Mike Timoshek, who attended recent information sessions hosted by Dr. Corinne Cash about the impact of Hurricane Fiona in 2022. Both said government officials should be proactive and spend more time reviewing the conditions in the Lewisburg-Gabarus area to prevent wildfires. Cash wants to keep the discussion ongoing with plans to address the matter at a future CBRM council meeting. This week on The Good Sentence, Paul McDougall talks baseball with Jim Rico McHachran, longtime manager of the Sydney Sooners, who are celebrating their 50th season, and Lowell Cormier, who once played in those early years.
Okay, I'm here today with two interesting people from Cape Breton's baseball past and present and future. So I have Jim Rico McHachran, who's the manager of the Sydney Sooners, which are celebrating their 50th season this year. They began in 1977, if you can believe that, and Lowell Cormier from New Waterford, who played on that team. So let's start off with you, Rico. Just tell us a little bit about the year 1977 and the formation of the Sydney Sooners.
Well, I think I'd reflect back to 76, because the 76 Sydney Steel Kings were the forerunners of the 77 Sydney Sooners. In 1976, we won the provincial championship under Fred Compton, was handling that team at that time, owner of that team at that time. And we had a group of 12 that played that year. I remember we nicknamed ourselves the Dirty Dozen, because we always, when we scheduled games, we always had to make sure that we had at least 9 on the ball field. But we won the provincial championship, and at the same time, that winter in 76, there was word on the mainland that they were forming a provincial senior league. Of course, we hadn't heard anything about it, but when we heard that, and with the success that we had in 76 with the Steel Kings, we made the appropriate contacts out of Halifax, and that was the start of the story. I think the first league meeting of that fledging league was January of 77, and so we went to that first meeting, and so it started from there and followed through. And so the summer of 1977 would have been the first inaugural season.
Of the Sydney Sooners.
Of the Sydney Sooners in that provincial senior league.
Which would have morphed out of one of the longest names of any baseball team ever, right? The Sydney KFC Steel Juniors Steel Kings. How did that name go?
Yes, you make a good point, because I can remember that was a junior team,
right,
of the same Steel Kings organization. And I remember, I'm going to say it was Camrose, Alberta. We were at National, and the name, by the time the announcer had the name listed for the first batter, the inning had pretty well ended.
Crazy.
But anyway, what we had, I remember that year, Cape Breton Tartan hats, and each player was given two. And I'm telling you, in Alberta, they were pretty popular because like every fan from Alberta wanted to try and track down one of them tartan hats. But
for sure.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, 77, Lowell, you were on that team.
Yeah, I was on that team. It was the first year in the league. It was a pretty exciting time. I had played with Rico and the Steel Kings in 1974 when we finished second in the Nationals in North Battleford, Saskatchewan. And then after that, I was in summer school, teacher summer school. I was a teacher, but I had to go to summer school to take special education. So I played mostly fastball. But I was on the – I played one game in 76. This is the way Freddie operated. They had me on a card, and I played one game in 76 with that championship team. I played against St. Peter's in the fifth game of that series. They were missing a right fielder, so Bernie McKinnon made the call, and I came in and played one game. And so then they went on to Yarmouth to win the provincial championship, and I went back to the Waterford to play softball. My recollection of that very first year was there was a lot of hype around there. And, you know, I never really knew what went into the league. Had no idea. That just that Rico was our front man. Mm-hmm. And Rico was making all the arrangements. And I can remember having team meetings and trying to decide what uniforms we were going to order and stuff like that. But my only...
Boston Red Sox uniform. Yeah. It was the same uniform that the Boston Red Sox wore in 77. One of the I think it was yourself, Lowell, wasn't it? That you were a big Boston. To this day.
And still has the hat on.
I don't think there could have been a chance that we were going to get any other combination of colors or whatever. Because Lowell was promoting it out pretty strongly. So the Boston uniform that year was the uniform that we wore for the first Sydney Sooners team in 1977.
Who picked the name the Sooners?
Well, that's an interesting story. I was telling that story not that long ago. I should write it down because it would be a shame to not have that somewhere in history. I attended the meeting in January, and Jimmy Pelham was the contact equivalent to me for the Halifax Pelham team that was entering mm-hmm. the senior league. It's the new fledging league as well.
Pelham Electric.
And when I went to pick up Jimmy in Halifax to go to the meeting, which was in Halifax, Jimmy mentioned, he says, when we get there, they're going to want to know the teams that are going to enter this new league and their full name. Well, we hadn't talked about any name. And Jimmy, I remember, emphasized, he says, I think the media will be disappointed if we can't tell them, you know, Halifax something or Sydney something. I was sitting in Jimmy's living room watching the Nebraska Cornhuskers and the Oklahoma Sooners play University football on his TV that Sunday afternoon, and I can remember saying Sydney Cornhuskers, and I said nothing there, don't work,
that's not going to fly.
And then I said Sydney Sooners. I said I like that, I like the alliteration of the S.
Yeah,
that'll do as well as anything.
There you go.
And thus, when we went to the meeting, they asked Sydney's name. And I stated, well, it's been settled and satisfied. Sydney Sooners is what we picked, and that's what it will be. Over the years, there's been a number of interviews done on where the name come from. What's right. the connection? And I used to say to them, I'd love to tell you a real interesting story that Sooners came from some famous family that were the first in Sydney. Yes. Or whatever.
Yes, the Sooners from Ashby.
Whatever. But I said, and then I'd give the background of the story of watching the football game.
Yeah.
But that's exactly where, and to this day, like I say, if you're around long enough calling yourself the same thing,
yeah,
eventually it catches on. Because for the first 10 years, we were called Sydney Schooners. I used to get, my line used to be, we're spending millions of dollars on our advertising campaign, and you're going to call it Schooners? So at the time, the Schooner beer was very famous, so people related to that.
That's right.
But over time, I don't get that air very much now.
Yeah.
And we even have in Sydney, the Little League rep teams, they've all taken on the name. So
fantastic. Yeah. If you needed a new team name now, you'd have to hire like 10 people with MBAs and pay them $1 million to come up with it.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
No, that's fantastic. So it's 50 years. There's been many teams in the Nova Scotia Senior Baseball League. Presently, there's 5 now, but at one time there were, you know, in and out 14 or 15 different teams. But how do you explain the longevity, basically, of the league and Sydney's participation in it from day one?
Well, for the league, I can probably reference, we had excellent executives. And I brag the league every chance I get, because some places with some organizations, and I'm not going to name them, okay, some can be provincial, some can be national, you don't have that. Sometimes things are done for the wrong reason. We had an executive that the senior league was the big thing. That's what they're always defending, always promoting. And I think I could safely say in 50 years, I don't know if there was ever a year that there was a national championship that Nova Scotia was not represented. I don't think anywhere else across the country can the other provinces say that. They all sort of took hiatuses because of the distance have to be traveled, the costs that would be incurred or whatever. But religiously, the Nova Scotia Senior Baseball League has been providing a representative at the national championship every single year. I remember, I'm going to guess again, I think it was 1992, one of the team that had won the championship the year before was scheduled to go to the national, and in February we were informed, just because the costs involved, and they had been to the previous national, just couldn't do it on cost. The league in February came up with a formula of how we would pick an all-star team depending on what your standings would be the following summer by July 1st. And so first place team, well, the team that was supposed to go had a core of 10.
Right.
That they provided that. And then the rest of the teams in the league, it depended on where you were sitting. We got to send 2 ball players that year because I think we were sitting in 5th place July 1st of that summer. That team went, it was in British Columbia. That's why I referenced the heavy cost to to any team that was required to go out there. It was in British Columbia, and lo and behold, didn't they go out and they won the national.
Wow.
And amazing.
Yeah, and there's 2 ball players that we sent from our team.
Who are those 2 guys?
Jeff McClellan and Jason Snow. And I hope I'm correct on that, because I hate to miss if there was a 3rd, but I'm positive Jeff and Jason would tell me in a hurry, because it was a highlight, I know, of their baseball careers.
So for the Sooners, you've won 6 Nova Scotia championships already, correct?
Yes.
Yeah. Out of 50 years. That's a pretty good...
1982 and 1983, back-to-back years we won. Both of them exciting final series. And then most recently in 2013, 2014, and 2017, we won 3 of 5 years.
Yeah.
That's a
big deal.
We had
plus 89.
Yeah. Plus 82, 83, and 89.
Yeah.
6 of them, yeah.
Yeah.
But, you know, I enjoyed the national exposure in that and enjoyed it more for the players that you would take to it. But for me, it was always the regular season pennant. To win that with the schedule that the Cape Breton teams had, like you were traveling every second weekend. The mainland teams would come in here maybe one weekend out of the summer, but we'd be going every second weekend in order to... So I always said, if you're able to win that regular season pennant, that was as big an achievement almost as winning the championship.
Yeah.
But obviously, it doesn't get the same ring or bang of the bell sort of thing.
There's always been a fan base for the Sooners games. Lowell, you want to just talk a little bit about... Because you're, I mean, you go to as many games as you can now, and often behind the screen. Just talk a little bit about that and how important that is.
Well, I think Rico's crafted that over the years, and he's put a lot into promoting the club, and he's put a good product on the field. And you get the people that follow the team, that are friends and family, but then you get the best baseball lifers. He's getting a lot of seniors there. We put our lawn chairs behind the backstop and watch. But you know, early in the early years, like in 77, we lost in the final of the league championship that Rico was talking about, and it was to Yarmouth. And it was always came down to a pitching duel between Bobby Gillis and Keith Bridgeau. It was amazing. The scores were 1-0, 2-1. That kind of ball was being played, right?
Yeah.
And the big rivalry then for the Sooners was St. Peter's. We used to packer for St. Peter's when St. Peter's came down. They were a pretty able squad, and the rivalry was pretty intense. So going forward now, over the years, I think the fan support has been good. The fan support manifests in the playoffs just like anything else. No, the fan support's been really good, and I think it's a combination of a consistent program and Rico's management of the PR around the team.
I would have been in grade 12 in 1977. I just lived up the hill there on Herbert Street, so just in behind Centennial Ring. So you literally just roll down the hill into the Archibald Avenue, right?
Yeah.
And I remember, that year and lots of crowds, and baseball was a really big deal. But, 50 years later, six provincial championships. You just on the past weekend when the opening series, you won the three games. And you've also put out a challenge to the team. What's that challenge, Rico?
Well, I suggested that the best thing they could reward me with for my time in would be in this 50th year, which basically for the last 6 years I've been crawling to get to, and that we win our seventh championship. And like I say, and I'm not one to do that very often. I don't announce pitchers half hour before game time. That might be when they find out. I'm not one to say on Wednesday, here are the three starters for the weekend, because I never believed that was creating any advantage for anyone. But so for me to throw that out, I always would say, let's make the playoffs, and then it's a whole new season anyway, and we'll go from there.
Yeah.
Take a little bit of the safe zone. But yes, this year I threw the challenge, and I was watching one of the games being played on television earlier last week, and they interviewed the coach of one of the other teams from the mainland. Again, I'm being very political in not mentioning names so I don't get calls after. But anyway, that coach basically threw out the challenge that they missed winning it last year, were totally disappointed, and they're coming full bore.
Yeah.
So we happen to have that team coming in 2 weeks to play us, and they're playing us four games here in Sydney. I'm hoping we can take a few games in that series anyway to see if we can start that run to that championship, you know?
Yeah, no, it's... It's a great league. I still try to get to games now and then myself. Most of them are on, it's pretty well every second weekend, right?
Yeah.
When you're at home. You've got a Facebook site that's pretty active. If people were to go and look at that, the Sydney Sooners Facebook, you would see just last weekend you retired your first number, right? That's a fairly big deal. You want to tell us about who you retired?
Well, yes, with pleasure. I'll tell you, that sort of snuck up on me because personally, I've always not really jumped all over that. Kenfield does that very well. Matter of fact, their whole Oldfield fence has about a dozen numbers they've retired, and quality ball players. But as I reflected, I was trying to think of over 50 years. I think, I can't give an exact number, but I think we'd be approaching 1,000 or over 1,000 ball players that have played in those, in that. Now, that sounds like if you turned over every one with 20 players on a roster, but when I think of, you know, what starts and what finishes, we'd be approaching 1,000 anyway now of ball players, so... for whatever the reason was, and we've had some excellent ball players, have brought in some excellent imports.
Oh, yeah.
And but there was one individual that, you know, kept jumping up when I was setting my little categories as to, okay, who's deserving of... And we have never thrown out a first pitch. I don't know if we're negating... an obligated ceremony that most teams do, but we had never done that I can recall in 50 years. So as I said to the individual, and that individual was George McLean,
yeah.
I said, George, I don't know how important this will be to you, but to our fraternity, this is an important event and an acknowledgement of George put in a quarter of a century.
Yeah,
I'd say with the ball team.
Yeah,
he coached after his playing days were all but winding down. He actually came out and gave me relief for 2 years coaching, and like I say, his years for playing with the club, especially his. 30 to 40, that age mm-hmm. for him.
Yeah.
Whatever team was going to national, he was a name that was always on that list as far as picking up players and always performed well at nationals.
Yeah.
So it was a special treat to be able to set that up. Unfortunately, it was the first game of this past weekend. The first game of the season, we wanted to do it first pitch of the 50th yeah. season. So George did throw out the first pitch, but the weather was that horrendous
yeah.
that I have to admit the grandstands weren't full.
There you go.
Okay, as yeah. much as we reflected, we right. had some big crowds.
Yeah.
And not to digress, but Lowell made a great point. I would like to make it too. St. Peter's series. We were 4 and 5 deep, I can remember. Now, I tell them that today. The grandstands would be filled, and they'd be 4 and 5 deep to the Oldfield fence
yeah.
going down the sidelines.
Yeah.
Especially the series that we had. St. Peter's brought as many in as we would take to St. Peter's.
Yeah.
That would travel. They were a great series, and I'll tell you, it was enjoyable, we ended up having the fortune, good fortune, of being able to have a number of those St. Peter's players when they folded their ball club. There were ball players right. like, I shouldn't try and call on my memory now, but the Goos, Billy DeGoo. I forget that was the...
You picked up some of them.
Yeah, well, in the Mans, Robbie and Richie Mans,
oh, yes.
yeah. they were picked up for yep. Mm-hmm. Nationals in Newfoundland, and Robbie played a full season with us. I think won a batting title that year yeah. while playing with us. But that was a great relationship we had with the St. Yeah. Peter's. when Lowell referenced, the attendance, that's what reflected in my mind was as many as we get in the ballpark now, especially come playoff time, nothing matched that.
Yeah, not even close.
Well, I think as I read about, the earlier days, the what they call, H&D in Halifax, but here it was the Calgary League, or...
Yes, the Calgary League,
probably.
Yeah, I've written about that in the Cape Post,
The attendance they used to have, I would have loved to have been around
Hundreds into the thousands of some of those games.
I bet.
They had huge crowds then.
Yeah.
Huge as a relative term, right?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. But I can remember being at the Waterford Giants Woodstock Maritime title in 1959 as a 10-year-old.
Wow. Yeah,
and they had about 4,500 in.
Yeah.
And that would be the days of Roberts at shortstop. There was more than one big name.
Carl Marsh at second base.
Oh, yes.
Dan Willie Buchanan at...
Yeah. New Waterford.
First. Spike. Bozo Steele. Bozo Steele at third base. Exall, right field, and pitching.
Yeah.
Yeah, I know. I mean, there's... But... That was one of the heydays, and the closest I think we got to that after that was Sooner St. Peter's.
Yeah, that's really cool. So, long tradition, well over 100 years of baseball here in Cape Breton, right in the local area. So, easiest way for people to see games, it's every second weekend from now on into the end of August at the Susan B. McCachran Field in Ashby and Sydney. Go to their Sydney Sooners Facebook. You can find out exact dates and who they're playing. Gentlemen, wishing you good luck this season. And hopefully, what do you think, Lowell? Rico's wishes, is the dream going to come true?
I watched them on the weekend. They've got potential if they can gel and keep everybody healthy.
Okay.
I haven't seen all the teams, but I know what was around last year.
Yeah.
They've got a shot. I think it could be destiny.
Yeah, there we go. So, if you're at the game, you can usually find Lowell somewhere in behind the home plate, probably having a hot dog by third inning, right?
Yeah.
Great hot dogs there, Rico, by the way. Who's ever cooking them?
Yes.
Once again, good luck and thanks.
Okay, thank you very much, Paul.
The federal government has announced a major investment in Marine Atlantic's North Sydney Terminal. The Coast 89.7's Jacob Hostewaite reports.
$80 million will go towards improving infrastructure at the terminal, which provides a ferry link between Nova Scotia and Newfoundland and Labrador. Marine Atlantic says planned work includes dock extensions and auto mooring upgrades, along with electrical improvements to support shore power. The announcement was made at the terminal by Sydney Glace Bay MP Mike Kellaway, who spoke about what the investment will mean for Cape Breton.
What this is going to do, it's going to develop infrastructure for tomorrow today and do it right away. It's about jobs. It's about spin-offs here in the north side and the rest of the Seabourn and the rest of Cape Breton. Prime Minister Carney has been pretty exact on this, that to improve our supply chain, to double our non-US exports, to become masters of our own present and history, we need to do things differently in terms of reimagining and re-engineering our economy. And that is actually what we're doing here. We're investing in people, we're investing in infrastructure. I always say this, and I know for the rest of the MPs on either side of the aisle, they probably get tired of me saying it, but I'll say it again because I think it's important, that when you invest in Cape Breton, I have every confidence in the world, Cape Breton is going to provide so much more back in results. Because we have the talent and expertise. We have the commitment. And now we have a prime minister that is looking at making those investments now.
Following the announcement, Cape Breton Regional Municipality District 1 Councillor Gordon McDonald, who represents parts of North Sydney, shared his feelings.
Hey, it's a great announcement. Exciting to hear that the minister come here and they're going to invest $80 million into Marine Atlantic. So it's a fantastic day to hear this. Well, for the north side, I mean, having Marine Atlantic here is an economic pillar. It's, you know, it's the biggest asset we have. It's the most important driver economically this community has. And it covers all of the north side. And, you know, it's as... What else could you ask for when it comes to having this type of business here in your backyard?
Marine Atlantic Vice President of Operations Daryl Gallant spoke about what the investment means to them.
It's huge. It's just fantastic for us as an organization. We're so fortunate to have this announcement today from MP Kellaway and support we have from the Government of Canada. And it's fantastic news for all our customers. The people of Newfoundland, you know, all those that are in Newfoundland and Labrador that rely on our service. It's just a big event for us.
He discussed what passengers will notice once the work is complete.
Improve reliability, service improvements, and greater efficiency within our terminals and terminal operations. So, you know, everything we've talked about here today from extending dock extensions makes it easier for, you know, to accept some of the challenges that we've had with climate change, to be able to connect our vessels when they arrive in port to electric power, to our grid, to cut down on utilizing our main engines and reducing then our carbon footprint. These are all beneficial to not only, you know, to us as Marine Atlantic, but to everyone in the communities and that we work within, right?
Kellaway also spoke about the importance of the investment.
Well, I think what it's going to do is it's going to assist in creating a more reliable, more accessible, more efficient dock for these vessels that take product and people from Cape Breton to Newfoundland. It's kind of on par for what we're doing as a government, looking at key assets, infrastructure assets that are important to the supply chain for Canada. This is absolutely one of them. So what this will do, it'll provide a more environmentally sound approach to the dock in particular. A lot of upgrades that have been on the back burner for some time. Well, they're no longer on the back burner. This infrastructure, it's a complete revamp of this entire area, which I think is really important to make, you know, that fluid approach to traveling a reality. We've upped our game. We'll continue to up our game at Marine Atlantic in terms of getting people from point A to point B. But this is also comes a result of a lot of hard work on the part of Marine Atlantic advocating. I advocated very hard for it, being in my riding, of course. But also, more importantly, it is like one of those top-tier infrastructure transportation assets that we have that need investment in the future. So why not make it now?
Kellaway teased additional announcements that will be made this summer in other parts of the CBRM.
You may have heard about the Sydney Public Market moving to the Sydney Waterfront campus. And in this interview, Dialogue's Cora Perrigo speaks with Ocean Lee, and they touch on some other topics as well.
What was the reason behind changing the location for the summer?
You know, we're really thrilled to be able to be at the NSSC Sydney Waterfront. It's actually one of our top choices when we started the Sydney Public Market. So being able to have it here is fantastic. There's lots of parking. It's right on the waterfront. And the space is so beautiful and very spacious as well. So it allows us to be able to have a market that has performances. Vendors have more space to maneuver, and we'll have even more vendors. So being able to have more opportunities for newcomers and local members here that's looking to incubate their business. NSSC represents a community hub, and we're all about supporting our community here. And that's one of our goals, being able to connect newcomers and locals alike. And a lot of our staff are actually NSSC students. So being able to help incubate and give them opportunities to be able to explore a career path, especially working with the Multicultural Association, Cape Wren. So we do have some amazing staff right now that is alumni or actually in school for NSCC.
And so you kind of mentioned performances. What does it kind of look like?
Oof, my goodness, great question. We have, for our opening, we have Ben Smith and Bria Kelly. They're going to bring some really great East Coast tune. They're members of the East Coast, amazing band. We're going to have Jenny doing traditional Chinese dance as well. So throughout the whole summer, we're going to be able to support local and newcomer performances. So we're looking forward to having more Cape Wren flavors, as well as African drumming, Latin dancing, and everything in between.
And so the Sydney Public Market has been running for almost a year, a little bit over a year now.
Yeah, that's right.
How has it grown? How did, like, you know, obviously we're changing location for a few months, but how has it grown? How have you had to kind of maneuver around challenges? How has that worked out?
Yeah, for sure. For us, we always wanted to be, especially downtown in this area. Our first market was actually called the Muku Market, which was short for the Multicultural Market. It was held at our friend's location at the Eldwick Art Center, and we were able to have cultural performances, vendors and food vendors alike, a really wonderful space. And then we were able to have our own space at 222 Charlotte Street. But once we moved in there, we realized we already outgrown the space. So we're using that 222 Charlotte Street location as our multicultural hub. So our goal is to have like a full retail space that has products that you can come in every single week, like milk and eggs and cheese. And then we also have, ideally, a coffee vendor and flagship tenants there. And in the back, we're looking to have co-working space. So being able to actually really start incubating ideas and connecting newcomers and locals together. So our 222 location will be a multicultural hub. And our new home at NSCC Sydney Waterfront will be the Sydney Public Market. And it is a trial for the summer and fall, and we hope it will be our forever home.
So say it is, you know, at NSCC kind of for the foreseeable future, how would you see it? I know you said performances. How would you like to see it grow? How would you like to see it evolve and change?
Right now, we have more capabilities at NSCC. So we're able to have more vendors. We're able to have more food vendors. We're able to house indoor and outdoor space. For our opening, we have salsa lesson, and we also have yoga. And Aline Bray from Bayou Bellows, we're doing ironwork demonstration. So being able to have more activation stations, especially for families to come in and experience the market and actually have activities for them to do. So it's not only just shopping, but it's listening to the music and the performances, but also having a space where kids can do crafts and the newcomers are able to engage and use their culture and tradition to really be part of the community. So one of our goals with the Multicultural Association is to be able to have newcomers really lead by example by using the culture, their food, to really integrate to the community.
Is it important for you that the Sydney Public Market stays downtown?
It really is, because for us, a lot of newcomers are located downtown. So when we started like our first market, it had to be downtown and it had to be on a weekend, which is a Saturday, because on Sundays, really at that time, there wasn't really any bus transportation. And a lot of our base was walking to the market. And it was just around the corner from where they lived. So we wanted to make sure that it was downtown. We also want to make sure that it's a year-round initiative as well. Most of all our projects are year-round, because we want to ensure that the opportunity is not seasonal, but it's year-round. So we definitely wanted to be downtown, and that's our goal, and we're thrilled that we can continue to have our market downtown. Also, it's a great way to access the cruise ship passengers that are coming, the tourists that come here, our locals that live around the area, our newcomers that definitely live around the area. And we wanted just to make sure that we are incubating space downtown. CBRM has supported us, so being able to like showcase our region and our community to the world, I think, is really exciting.
Can you speak on all of the projects you have going on downtown?
Ooh, we do have the Whale House. The Whale House is just across the street on 14 Wentworth Street. If people don't know where it is, you just have to look for the building with a whale. That's why we called it the Whale House. It's a food incubator. So what that means is we have a commercial kitchen and we have a food vendor each day that represents a culture. So come July, we have Mexican food on Sunday. We have also Honduras food on Saturday. And then we also have Kraken Pizza on the weekend. Monday, we have Nigerian food. Tuesday, we have Vietnamese food. And Friday and Thursday, we have Ukrainian food. So each day, it's going to be a great way for you to connect with newcomers from our community and also to support them. 100% of the money raised goes directly to the food vendors. It is food incubator. So what that means is not 100% fully established for the vendors. That means it allows them to grow, make mistakes, test the food, test the pricing, test their container, practice their English, just make those connections. So it's not like a full pledge restaurant, but it's a place where newcomers and locals are able to start incubating and sort of do like a test kitchen, a pilot project, and see what works, what doesn't work. And it doesn't break the bank. So we're really proud that food vendors are able to start and practice and grow their business at the Whale House. And once they fix the kink, hopefully they grow and grow and grow and they can have their standalone shop. We're really thrilled that a success story that came out of it is Kraken Pizza. Carl and Danielle, really great couple, making the best pizza, I think, on the island. They started at the Whale House, and now they're grown to have their own standalone place, and they're going to be located in the new Dawn building, most likely the start of August. So we're really thrilled about that. So when they leave, we have Mexican and Honduras cuisine coming in. So it's a revolving door, but we love it because it means that they're growing.
With all of these projects, it seems like the downtown revitalization, something that people talk about a lot, is very important to you.
Oh, absolutely. We have a lot of newcomers that live around this area, locals as well, and youth. Just giving them space and access to things that they can do downtown. I know CBRM is really making a great push. We have downtown city development. We have the chamber located downtown. A lot of tourists will come down here. So being able to have events downtown allows us to be able to create an ecosystem that allows other business to flourish. And when we do our social media, whether it's the Sydney Public Market or the Whale House, we always try to tag and support our neighbors as well. We have great neighbors. We have Sulky's, we have Gallery, you know, we have Celtic Thrift. So being able to not only have our space, but to promote our friends and neighbors, I think it's really important. And weekends are fantastic. Also, it's free parking at CBRM. So you can't really beat Saturday and Sunday free parking. You park anywhere downtown.
Is there anything else that you're thinking about kind of down the pipeline?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Again, we're with our space because we're moving the Sydney Public Market from 222 Charlotte Street. That's going to be transformed to something I think that's going to be incredible. Hopefully to have a community hub where newcomers and locals can come and come with ideas and not only have those ideas, but network and make it into realities. We hope to host workshops there, lunch and learn. So being able to start incubating those ideas to make it to reality that we hope will be year-round, that will create opportunities, especially employment opportunities for newcomers and also locals. Again, we have that retail space, so being able to have folks coming in to shop weekly to know the fact that they can get bread, they can get produce, they can get milk, they can get cheese, and it's all going to be supporting maritime businesses, and hopefully we can have flagship tenants. So for example, Bungalow Bean Steve can serve coffee. He's a roaster, and you could get coffee directly from the roaster, which I think it's so important. And with Bungalow Beans, we hope that becomes like a teaching site as well. Being able to have newcomers volunteer or work at Bungalow Beans to practice their English and to really connect with the community. I think it's a really great space for us to have. Also in the pipeline, oh, there's tons. But upcoming in the new year, we have a solar garden project. So garden is always like one of those, is it a garden? What exactly is it? So it's solar panels. We are going to have a solar panel farm where we're going to cultivate electricity that goes back to the grid, which is Nova Scotia Power. So then we're able to sell our electricity or power to Nova Scotia Power. And in turn, we're going to give a discount to newcomers. About 220 families will get an automatic discount on their power because right now it's on the high end. So we're finding ways that we can be, especially promoting renewable energy and clean energy. So we have that solar garden that's planned for the spring, and that means we need to actually build it. So we are working with NSCC right now to come up with a certificate program where we can have a local and newcomer youth to be able to be a cohort to learn about the solar panel installation where they can work on the project. And even though the build itself would take less than a year, the maintenance of it will be between 20 to 25 years. So being able to have locals here and newcomers the opportunity to not only build a solar garden, but also learn to maintain it. And I know the province is going in that direction. So being able to have multiple of these solar projects where our kids here and our youth are able to learn and to have that as one of those reliable careers path that they can choose.
And can you share some basic information on kind of just the where, when, about the upcoming opening?
Yeah, this Saturday, everyone's June 27th, 10 a.m. to 2 p.m. at NSCC Sydney Waterfront, which is located in Building B, which is their main building. But don't worry, you won't get lost because we'll have volunteers that can direct you from any direction that you come to downtown Sydney. We'll have volunteers to show you where the main entrance is. But it's going to be great because we have parking, over 150 parking spaces available, and a quick walk, which will take no more than 3 minutes, guaranteed. You can walk on the waterfront, Esplanade, anywhere you like. It'll only take you no more than 3 minutes to get to the main entrance of the Sydney Public Market.
That was Ocean Lee on Sydney Public Market's move to NSCC on the waterfront and more upcoming projects.
That's all for Dialogue this week. If you have an idea for an interview on the program, send us an email to news@coastalradio.ca. Thanks for listening. I'm Bill McCush.